I'd like now to welcome Yolanda Nava. She's with the National Hispanic Cultural Center and New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. And Lois Ellen Frank, who is a culinary anthropologist, food historian, chef, and photographer. And the two of them are co-authors of the book Good Food, Good Health, From Field to Feast Wellness Handbook. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So this is a stapled sort of long book, what would you call it, long booklet, short book, whatever, have with lots of good common sense health information, from food to medicine to lifestyle to stress to various problems that people have. This is an initiative of the National Hispanic Cultural Center, New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. What was the motivation to have this book, which is being distributed to a lot of people for free?
Well, the motivation was that we were, the National Hispanic Cultural Center and the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque, were funded to do a collaborative initiative by the New Mexico Community Foundation called From Field to Feast, a celebration of our common culture, food, and agricultural practices. And this initiative began last year, and the programming began last fall. As a result of that, I thought, because I had been involved in health, you know, when I was a broadcast journalist, you know, in California, and I continue to be, concerned about health issues, particularly here in New Mexico, I thought that people, our target audience, are Native Americans and Hispanics because of the two organizations, and I thought we needed to give people tools to help them make healthier choices, because Hispanics and Native Americans are at severely high risk of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. The situation is really chronic here as well as across the nation for these two groups. So I wanted to give them tools. So I found, I went out, I made the proposal, and I solicited funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for Health Sciences at the University of New Mexico, and they very generously came in as our funder for the first 10,000 copies. And when we went through that batch very quickly, like in about 6 weeks, we then got funding from Conalma and from the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, who took some of their money for this year to put into the book, and went with another 10,000. We've almost distributed all 20,000 copies of books in English. We now have a 10,000 edition of Spanish that we're going to be distributing at no cost, and the reason we could do it at no cost is because we had the private funding, because they saw the need to get information out into the hands of these two target audiences.
Now, when the book is distributed, do you have any sense that people are reading it? Are you getting feedback? Is there also an interactive component where you're either lecturing or conversing with the people who get the book?
We haven't really had that much interaction beyond, you know, our personal connections. But when I took a couple cases of the book up to Taos Pueblo last fall, and I met with the wellness coordinator up there, and he just said to me, he said, you know, how did you find me? You know, he says, you have no idea how much we're suffering here. And you know, that nobody talks to them. There's no, you know, there's a disconnect. And there's not the information available to, you know, to the people on the Pueblo. And he was very, very grateful.
What kind of suffering are they going through?
Health,
up there?
I mean, particularly diabetes and obesity. And then from those illnesses, you have a whole array of other things which go awry. I mean, it's... you get depression. I mean, there are a lot of problems that are ancillary to, you know, any disease. So that motivated me to present the idea of having a movable feast as well as the feast, because we celebrated a feast in Albuquerque last year with the National Hispanic Cultural Center and the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, and so I thought, well, why don't we take the feast out into the communities as funding enables us to do so. So this year we're going to be doing Lois Ellen Frank will be doing a healthy cooking demonstration. We'll have a feast, and then we'll have a nutritional presentation by a nutritionist from UNM.
Now let's talk about the feast. What do you serve?
Well, we're still working out some of the menu details, but I think the concept is to be able to take something that's not hugely expensive, make a menu, and make that available to, let's say, a family of six or a family of eight, and we're going to demonstrate how to do it, and then to use all the parts. For instance, if you make a baked chicken with vegetables. You can then take the chicken carcass and make a delicious stock, which is very nutritious, and then make another meal out of that to feed your family a second time. So we're really trying to look at how to take good food that's healthy food and make it economical for communities that may not have a lot of extra money to spend and maximize the nutritional value in some of these meals and part of the feast.
What are the best ways to maximize your dollars and get really good healthy food? I mean, obviously going to some of these very wonderful but very expensive natural food stores isn't going to be the way if you want to stretch your bucks.
Well, I think two components would that stick out in my mind. One is eating, going back to what I would call the indigenous foods, or the foods that come from, that existed in New Mexico before contact, and then foods that the Spanish brought with them. So a combination between the Native American foods that existed here with the foods introduced and brought by the Spanish. So you have beans, you have corn, you have chilies, squash, all of which are very nutritious, inexpensive, and then a lot of times if you can reintroduce those seeds and have a small garden and plant those, a lot of those foods will last. Beans will last from one season to the next. I still have pumpkins from last season that I'm using now strictly for seeds, but they'll last, they'll winter over, and the flesh will still be edible all the way into March. And so there's a lot of ways that we can take traditional practices that have existed in New Mexico for literally hundreds, in some cases thousands of years, and bring those foods back. Those are the foods that have kept alive our ancestral elders, and those are the foods that we need to make sure remain alive and are vital and reintroduced into many of the communities throughout New Mexico.
Food is really important because in the American diet, we've learned to rely heavily on a lot of fatty foods, a lot of processed foods, a lot of food with additives and chemicals and colorings and all kinds of stuff in it. Too much fat. We eat stuff that's fast food. Fast food is lovely for an occasional event, but some people are relying on it to feed their children every day or to provide a quick dinner at night, and that's not healthy because of the fat content, the poor quality of
And it's also not inexpensive.
No, it's very expensive.
It's very expensive. And yeah, the illusion is that it's not expensive, but when you start adding up the $5, $6, $7, or $8 per person, that's hugely expensive. For that same amount of money, you could have 2, 3, 4 meals that are much more nutritious, much higher in ingredients and vitamins that we need, and much less in fat and sugar.
My mother worked full time, and she used to prepare dinner every night. I would have dinner on the table, you know, within half an hour. And she always cooked from scratch and fresh, and everything was, you know, natural, fresh vegetables, fruits, and things like that. And when I had my own family, I did the same thing. I didn't rely on, in fact, I've told my husband, I didn't rely on processed foods. I told my husband, I said, you cannot go into the center aisles of the market. If you shop the perimeter, you're going to get your fruits, your vegetables, your meats, you know, your dairy products, the good stuff. When you go into the center part of the market, you get all the frozen and packaged stuff, and that has all the stuff in it. I think another thing that people need to look at is to look at the labels on the back of the packages, which tell you, you know, calorie content, fat content, how much protein, how much fat, how much carbohydrate. And, you know, you can really be bamboozled because you can be thinking you're buying something that's healthy because it's promoted that way on the front of the box, and yet you look at the back and it has 200 fat calories. And that
enough
adds
sodium
to,
for the entire day,
yeah,
and
right,
enough sugar for the entire day in that one processed food.
Right, right.
And some of us are alert to this, and even though I've had exposure to this for over 30 years, you know, you get lazy, you forget, you start eating differently. And when we started doing this project and I started reading labels again constantly, I was just flummoxed by how much bad stuff there is in particularly what you think is good food that you're purchasing. Even vegetarian items sometimes has a tremendous amount of fat in it, which, you know, none of us need so much of.
Right, and that's, you know, that's a marketing packaging thing. It says a vegetarian food, but then it's, you know, 80% vegetable fat.
Yeah. So it just takes, you know, being more conscientious. You know, the critical areas for our target audiences has been heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. And the hope is that these three major illnesses, which affect, you know, so many people, are totally preventable. I mean, unless you have a genetic something, and most people don't. It's that diabetes is something that comes on because you're eating incorrectly.
Way too much sugar and fat.
Yeah, too much sugar and fat, too much quantity, not getting enough exercise. And right now our youth groups are really highly at risk because teenage onset diabetes is just soaring. Obesity among the youth population is huge. They just had an article, two months ago, about preschool children mm-hmm. who are obese. And, of course, the figures are highest for Native Americans, then Hispanics, and then, you know, the general population. But the idea that little children, 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds, are already predisposed to obesity and diabetes is frightening in terms of the long-term consequences, because basically you have about 15 years after, you know, when you get youth-onset diabetes, and you're dead potentially because of all the crushing of organs, the damage that's done to your spine. I mean, there's a whole bunch of series of negative effects. So if parents can be more aware that a chubby baby is not a healthy baby, that, you know, that they feed their children differently, that they don't give them the 32-ounce tubs of soda water to start drinking when they're, you know, infants and toddlers, that you start training them differently and they appreciate drinking just water or a bit of natural juice, but drinking more other fluids.
There is a flip side to that that I think one has to be careful of, which is that if you feed a baby healthy food, you know, breast milk, and then it grows up and starts to eat regular baby food, some babies really are nice and chubby and round, and they're perfectly healthy, and then you get into this, like, everybody's supposed to be some kind of American ideal of thin.
There's a difference between being round or chubby, if you want to use that term, and obese.
Right.
And I think we're trying to differentiate the difference. When a child is carrying between 50 to 75 pounds of fat above what is considered normal for that child, they're going to struggle for the rest of their life to keep that weight off. It's just not something that you want to do to a child and then have them fight constantly to get it off. It's a lot easier to prevent it than to take it away.
And
I think that's where we're going.
Yeah, it starts when you're in the womb and how you're eating when you're pregnant and then how you feed that child afterwards and how you teach them about food. You know, most of us were trained, you know, eat everything on your plate because of the poor, starving, whatever group was referenced, the Armenians, whoever. And so you wanted to eat everything because there was this attitude of scarcity for some of us that were coming with parents who had gone through the Depression. But eating smaller amounts, eating more frequently during the day is healthier for you than one meal or three huge meals. And it does help you speed up your metabolism, and then you can, you know, you can maintain your weight. And then the exercise. Kids have not been having good PE classes, and they're not running and moving. They're sitting down with, you know, computer games or watching television. They really need to get out and hike and work and bicycle and do
garden.
Lots of fiddle garden. Yeah, Lois can talk about gardening.
I mean, there is a way that when you start to put these pieces together, a lot of things in a good way start to fit. For example, you start growing a garden, you start getting back to your indigenous food history, you turn off the television, and you spend more time with your family, you relieve stress. A lot of these things feed back on each other in a very good way.
They're interconnected, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, cooking is so important because, I mean, you know, I wrote a book, It's All in the Frijoles. It's not a cookbook. It's a book of virtues with a Latin twist. But the idea was that I learned all of my life lessons in the kitchen. I'm sure you did too, Lois. And, you know,
not me.
But my mother would cook dinner every night, and on the weekends we would often entertain and have family over. And, you know, while we were baking, you know, she would talk about, you know, why buy the cow when the milk is free, you know, and I got my sex education that way. But cooking is a really wonderful way to teach children your family history, your food history, your culture, to give them wisdom and to pass information on. And you know, the studies have shown that what families who sit down and eat together and talk about topics not only stay together, but the children perform better academically. And allowing your kid to go sit off by himself or herself and watch television and eat or not eat at the table with the rest of the family is not building the kind of social skills and the you know, family tradition skills that make for a good
and
family.
It literally bonds you not only within the family unit but with your community. Food is the one thing, regardless of size, shape, ethnicity, language, that we can all sit down at the same table and do. And we could. Literally, we could have 57 different countries at the same table speaking totally different languages, but we could share the same meal.
Right.
We might not be able to talk about the meal, but we could share the same meal. And so you start to see and celebrate in the diversity that we all share and in some of the characteristics, what makes us who we are and the stories of who we are. And the difference between eating a tree-ripened peach at the peak of the season from Velarde and a candy bar that's been processed and probably sitting on the shelf for a year to a year and a half to 2 years, seriously. And how delicious that peach is, and the story of the family that raised the peach, and the families that settled in the valley, and what they go through. And it's just amazing. And there's nothing like a tree-ripened fruit. There's nothing like harvesting your own corn or going to farmer's market. And I think New Mexico is pretty progressive in the sense that we are going back to these roots and revitalizing them, and it's alive in both communities.
Well, we have to. I mean, you have to have sustainable agriculture. The whole initiative of buying local and supporting, you know, local farmers. We often ship food 1,500 miles or more. We're paying a lot of money for all that transport cost. We're not getting fresh, you know, when's the last time you had a really good tasty peach unless you got it in Velarde or from a local farmer. So we're losing some of the sensory and economic benefits of growing local and supporting our local farmers and ranchers who produce, you know, lamb, chicken, and other products as well.
Now, some people live in first of all, in apartments where they don't have access to ground to plant things in, even if they want to. And then some people live in places.
You could grow a tomato on a windowsill. Mm-hmm.
You could grow a tomato on a windowsill, and that'll feed you for, you know, a couple of days. But there are also community gardens,
right,
and seed banks and all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Santa Fe, there was just an article in the paper saying that they are initiating 3 community gardens where people can sign up and have a plot of land. And depending on which garden, which location, that the water is going to be supplied by the city, which is a phenomenal opportunity for people to do.
That's
and
huge.
It is.
It is huge.
And then for Native American communities, Native Seed Search will offer free seeds to get them started in bringing back traditional agriculture, and they're based in Tucson, Arizona. So different Native communities can contact them, and they'll be given seeds. And so and other organizations that can sponsor seeds to get people started. And then what you want to do is save those seeds.
Right.
Because I remember always growing up and, you know, what did you grow? What do you have? And let's trade. And that's one of the first things I think that, you know, that the Chamayo chili seed is so coveted because it's so prized. It's not like any other seed in any other part of the state. And so everybody wants that particular seed as opposed to a seed maybe from the South or from California, which is not going to mm-hmm. produce the same chili. And so those are the things that we can keep alive. We would call those heirloom seeds and trade amongst each other and really covet because those are very special. They represent the history of New Mexico.
And even if you go to the supermarket and buy a squash, you can plant those seeds. Even if those squashes aren't from here, they'll probably grow, wouldn't they?
As long as they're not a hybrid. Hybrid plants mean that you genetically have to go back to the parents.
Uh-huh.
So if you bought a squash from Farmer's Market that was an heirloom squash, meaning that the original two parents on both sides, yes, you could plant that and save those seeds from then on.
But
it's only the hybrids that you can't.
But, I mean, if you go to Smith's and you buy a spaghetti squash or something like that, will it grow?
If it's not a hybrid,
yeah,
and
so
you'd have to ask.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Interesting.
Farmer's Market would probably be a better source for the squash that would have the indigenous seeds.
For seed saving, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at such an interesting moment because, on the one hand, there's this whole agribusiness continual winnowing away of diversity toward monoculture in food and everything else. And then you have this explosion of seed banks and this movement to go back to heirloom and indigenous seeds and plants.
Well, it's vital to retain the heirloom seeds and to continue those traditions because the food is hearty, it is more productive. Some of the studies that have misled a lot of the spending for the genetically altered seeds and plants, in fact, are not true. They do not provide for greater productivity for farmers, and that was a selling point to get this stuff into the markets, into the farmers' hands. So, you know, it's about balance, and it's about maintaining what works and what's healthy and what's good for you and what's affordable for the broadest number of people. If we're all dependent on a monotype food culture, we're stuck. You know, I call it global corporate colonialism.
Right.
You know, you're tied and you don't have the freedom to produce for yourself. I've heard stories in northern New Mexico that Many of the people there were able to sustain the economic depression of the 1930s because they had a pig, a cow, and they
some
grew
seeds.
Their own feed and some
yeah.
seeds. And
hell,
so you produce
your
own food.
Stories of people who say, what depression? Life yeah. is just the way it always was.
Yeah, yeah. And it's tight. You know, you don't have a lot of extra money to spend, but you can feed your family. And you can take that soup bone and you can make a soup or a stew or something with it, and you can feed your family.
So it's one thing to talk about it, and there's this wonderful book, Good Food, Good Health, From Field to Feast, Wellness Handbook. It's another thing to take that information and start living your life differently. Mm-hmm. What kind of support do people need to actually start implementing both culinary and other lifestyle changes?
I think you start small. You know, you set some goals. You say, I want to try this, and maybe you eat one day a week vegetarian. And then you
including
you know,
your beans and rice.
Including your beans and rice. And you just do it small. You don't try to make all the changes at once. Maybe you start with a few herbs in a pot on your patio or on your porch, and then maybe you put some in the ground and then
reintroduce homemade yeah. corn tortillas back into your family, and you get the kids going. We just did a class yesterday where she said, oh, my 3-year-old would love this, and the dough and the masa. And you make it an activity. Yeah. You make it something fun. You start to exercise one day a week, and then you go to 2 days a week.
Right.
And so I agree with Yolanda. It's like a pebble in the pond. And you drop the pebble in and you get those little ripples. But when you start to look overall, they ripple out and all of a sudden it's giant and you're totally healthy again. And you wonder, how did I do this or how did I get unhealthy because I feel so great now?
Yeah, and you will feel wonderful. You will feel wonderful when you eat better, when you exercise better. You get rid of depression. Your family is healthier. Your children are going to not be hyper because they're getting too much sugar or food coloring in their foods. I mean, it has a lot of benefits.
Yolanda Nava and Lois Ellen Frank are co-authors of the book Good Food, Good Health, From Field to Feast Wellness Handbook. If somebody wants to get their hands on this book, what should they do?
Well, they can contact me at yolanda.nava@state.nm.us. I don't think I can guarantee getting you English copies because I think we're about out of our 20,000, but I do have Spanish language copies that we just got a run of books in Spanish, so those are available. But it would be interesting to know how many people would like them, you know, and that's now. In the fall, the University of New Mexico Press will be including Good Food, Good Health in their fall catalog. It will be for sale. And it'll be a more expanded version of this book. I'd also like to mention that our our other author is R. Burciaga Valdez, PhD, who provided the medical expertise in the book. And so we want to mention that, you know, that's also another author on the book.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.